Welcome to Madlit Musings, the podcast where we dive into the minds of authors, exploring the profound realms of faith, social issues, and the delightful world of entertainment. I'm your host, Jamie Jill Wright, and on this literary journey, you never quite know what you're going to get. Hi, everyone. It is Jamie Jill Wright here at Madlit Musings, and I'm excited today because we have a new guest here on the podcast. New to me, it'll be new to you, but I have Mr. John Boyle with us. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Jamie. I'm excited.
I'm excited to have you here, too. And you're here to talk about your life story, but it centers around a book, a memoir that you brought out called The Appalachian Kid. Am I pronouncing that right? I've been told Wisconsinites do not pronounce it correctly.
You did a wonderful job in pronunciating okay. Appalachian. Yes.
I have a very dear friend who lives in that region, and she corrected me several years ago. It is not Appalachian.
Appalachian is
or Appalachia.
Yeah.
You know, or it's Appalachian if you're there. And then if you're from there, it's Appalachia, right?
Correct.
Okay. All right. So we got to get these things straight once and for all. If you're not from the Appalachia area, that's how you say it. Take it from a Wisconsinite. Okay. But anyway, John Boyle has written a book called Appalachian Kid. It's a story about the importance of kindness and mentorship, overcoming adversity and addiction, finding faith and hope, and helping those in need. So, John, I'm excited to chat more about this story with you today. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about what brought this book about and your story.
Sure. Well, to be able to answer that, I need to give you a little bit about my background. So I grew up in the middle of nowhere in West Virginia, in a little town called Kingwood. And growing up, I was not a good student. I was disassociated. I had a lot of difficulty. And really, you know, I kind of grew up in a violent home, but I didn't know it at the time. I was a kid. I was growing up, right? And so as I got older, I had more and more difficulty in school. And really, it was due to the fact that I was developing symptoms of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And when children are experienced with that, there is still some argument over how to classify it in the DSM manual. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's a psychological term. And, you know, essentially what it entails is whether it's complex or not, right? Because there is a differentiation between PTSD that a soldier gets as an adult and PTSD that a child gets, because it affects your neuron pathways and your sensory pathways and your neural networks, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's still a lot of work to be done. We still don't know exactly what the effect is, but, you know, I could go on and tell you more about it in a bit. But essentially, I had a lot of difficulty as a student. I almost failed 6th and 10th grade. And somewhere along the line in 9th grade, my father and I discussed the possibility of me attending a boarding school. And that was really my way out of my situation. And it more or less prepared me for life, really.
Okay.
So as I became an adult, I worked in a family business. I went to West Virginia University. I became an engineer and, you know, worked in a family business, and I was an estimator, and I ran projects, and I just did the best I could. And, when I was 29, my father had a heart attack, and I was put in charge of the operations of that company. And I moved along adulthood, running a family business and growing a family business. And there came a juncture in my life at 36 or 37 years old where I met a man on a trip, and he heard my story and recommended that I apply to Harvard Business School. Hmm. And like literally, Jamie, I busted out laughing at me, right? I'm like, there's no way Harvard University is going to let me in.
Right.
And so when I got there and I started conversing with my classmates and started attending classes that involved family business, really my story came to the forefront. And I had classmates that started to say, well, you really need to memorialize this in a book. And again, you know, kind of busted out laughing and said, I said things like, you know, I'm an engineer and I'm not an author. You know, I've never taken a formal writing class. I have no training as an author. I've never published or written anything to be published in my life before this book. And I blew it off and blew it off. And then the pandemic happened. And the business opportunities in my area in West Virginia really dried up. And I was given the time or afforded the time. And I sat down and I tried to work it out. And it took me a long time to write. But that is essentially how my book has come about. It's been a long, drawn out affair. And I was really surprised when I went to publish. I had no difficulty whatsoever in finding a publisher that wanted to take it.
Okay. Awesome. Well, it sounds like you have a very interesting background. And when I say that, I mean, lots of nuances. I'm giggling only because, you know, you talk about almost failing 6th and 10th grade and then going to Harvard. I mean, you know, that should spread some hope right there for anyone who is struggling in school that you can do it. You really
can.
That's
true. I'm from such a small place that the friends I have to this day are the same ones I went to first grade with. And my best friend is a guy named Moose, and he lives back in my hometown or close to it. And when he heard that I was accepted into Harvard, he actually drove to my house and asked me if it was just a small town rumor or it was actually true. Oh. Right? I mean, that shows you a big deal it was for me and to the people around me. So it's been a wonderful journey, and really I credit God with all of it. It's been a miracle.
That's awesome.
An absolute miracle.
That's really awesome. And, you know, so small town West Virginia, if I read correctly, you come from a family of generational coal miners, if that's correct. And that in and of itself is an interesting part of American history and American economy as it's wrapped up. I mean, a lot of us are so far removed from coal mining and that type of thing that we picture it as something from, you know, the early 20th century, and it doesn't, you know, but it still is really embedded into who we are as Americans today. So tell me a little bit about the culture, the area that you grew up in, and how that affected your story and where God has brought you along the way.
Well, let me start with where I'm from.
Okay.
I come from a small coal mining community, right? Not just my family, but really a community of coal miners. And if you didn't mine coal, you did something involved in some ancillary service like cutting timber to be used as mine cribbing, or trucking coal from a coal preparation plant to a railroad facility. But kindest people you'll ever meet. I mean, really, truly, some of the best people I've ever met in this world are from the region where I'm from. And I employed people from that region for decades. And the talent there is just unbelievable. And the work ethic is unbelievable. And they're self-motivated people. And they really don't complain. And if they're complaining, there's a big issue. I mean, the thing about coal miners and the thing about working underground that most people don't realize, right, is that when you go underground, you're taking your life in your own hands every day. And there's a mentality you have to have as somebody who goes underground to do that. And I won't say that I had that, right? I've always been an engineer that worked above ground, even though I've worked in the energy field for a long time. And so miners are very tough. They're very self-sufficient. Coal mining fathers do not listen to excuses. They don't want to hear them. You find a way to adapt and overcome. And I think it gives people who grow up in those areas, you do become hardened and callous to a certain degree, right? But you also are equipped with the skills of, you know, I'm going to do whatever I've got to do to make it, because that's what it's like here. And it is a tough environment. And you're not, it's not an overly abundant area. There are not other job, really, there are not a whole bunch of other careers that you can get into in outside of energy in the area where I'm from. And so you are susceptible to the ebbs and flows of the economic pricing of energy. And when the pricing is down, everyone's hard hit. and there's no relief. And when times are good, they're good, right?
Yeah.
So I hope I'm answering all your questions
Oh,
there, but do you
totally,
have some
totally.
more about it?
Well, I just think it's interesting, when you look at coal mining, I don't know how many of us in the, I don't want to say it's your own little shut off part of the world, but I think there's so much a part of our culture that doesn't realize how critical the mining culture is to the lives that we live on a regular basis.
No, absolutely. No question. And there are two types of coal. And I remember making the statement at Harvard Business School, and the majority of my classmates had no idea. I even went to school at Harvard with the former energy secretary of Spain. And I even educated him on this. There's two types of coal. One is metallurgic, which is cooked down in the form of coke, and it's used in the production of steel, right? Steel is just a carbon-based material. And the other type of coal is generally called steam coal, which is used in the generation of electricity.
Right.
And so, yeah, it powers whatever you want to do, whether you want to charge an electric vehicle or, it powers, your lights and your heating and your air condition. And, the metallurgical coal, it had to be used to form all the steel that you see when you drive down the road or you look in your own house.
Yep. I actually
It's the
worked
function of
for.
everyday society.
Yes, I agree. And I worked for a blacksmith for several years. He was an artisan. And so he created like this, beautiful, a lot of the iron railings and just amazing artwork out of steel. But that was, we would get shipments of coke in. And it was always so cool to me because I would go out and I don't want to say I would play with it, but you'd pick it up in your hand. It was just something that you don't typically get to see. I mean, you don't go out for a walk in the woods and pick it up off the ground, right? It's from inside the earth, right? And it's been mined. And then you just see it when you threw it into the forge and it would glow orange and then it would get white and all the different things that, he would tell me. He was like, okay, the orange, he's like, which one's the hottest part? And I'm like, the orange. And he goes, nope, the whiter it gets, the hotter it is.
Yeah. I
So.
think the purity also affects the flame color and coke, for those of your listeners who don't understand what it is just, it's coal cooked down to its purest form of carbon.
Right. Right. Yep. Yep. It's amazing stuff. Okay. So you grew up in that environment. So tell us a little bit about your background because I know you have quite the story to tell as far as your message of hope.
Sure. Sure. So, going back to just the part about PTSD and having the experience in childhood that I have, really it's shaped who I am as an adult. And it gave me an overwhelming amount of adversity that I've had to overcome. And so as I graduated from the boarding school I went to, which was in southwestern Pennsylvania, the same type of mining community that I left in West Virginia, really.
Okay.
Pittsburgh is, greater Pittsburgh area is just a steel production town. So after I left there and went back to West Virginia University, throughout high school, throughout college, even though my firsthand experience of the quote unquote war that went on my own house, that experience kind of lived on in my own head, for lack of a better way of explaining it. And what I didn't understand from 15 or 16 years old until really 36 or 37 was that all of these one-off symptoms that I thought were not related were. And so, a lot of my story has to do with how I overcome these personal symptoms, so to speak, of PTSD, which are, flashbacks, which are essentially nightmares that occur in the day with sometimes no vivid recollection in your mind, but you have these feelings that they're just all kinds of wacky. Sometimes those flashbacks can trigger a fight or flight response, which is not in any way congruent with what's going on in your daily activity. I may be at work or I may be watching a movie with my wife and all of a sudden I feel like I'm being shot at or there's a bomb threat. So I've had all these things I've had to overcome, and dysphoria, perpetually irritable, difficulty in regulation and regulating emotions. You know, I could go on and on. Insomnia has been one of the worst ones. And my way of dealing with these symptoms early on in college was, well, if I drink alcohol after my classes or when I have these symptoms come up, it seems to abate whatever's going on, right? And it gave me, on top of that, this false sense of euphoria. So, you know, why I say that is that there are so many people out there that have similar stories to mine and either don't make the connection until it's too late or cope with it the same way I have or worse, right? Get into drugs and other things that you can't come back from. And look, this is a common problem in our society that we really don't talk about,
right?
The people that talk about it are the ones that went through it, and they're trying to help the people who haven't got there yet. And I see myself as, you know, my mission is to tell my story to help others. Right. And so, you know, by me doing that, I feel that it gives me a lot of purpose. And obviously the book showcases my ability to do that. But essentially I got to the point where I was in my mid to late 30s, 36, 37 years old. And my body, in particular, my liver started to shut down from alcohol. You know, I was using it every day as a crutch after I got home from work, and it covered up a lot. And my body basically said no more. I started to turn white, very white, became malnourished. My liver began failing. And, you know, I was faced with, I was divorced at the time. You know, do I go and get help or do I just ride it out and say I'm goodbye? And I decided to be the dad my son needed me to be. I decided to begin to change how I approach my difficulties. And that's when I sought help. I went to a rehab facility in Florida for a month. And really, that's where I was diagnosed and came to know what problem I had, what disorder I had, rather, and began to learn how to equip myself with the tools I need to change the trajectory and to go about dealing with my difficulties in a more in a healthier manner. It's better said that way.
Yeah, there's a lot of stigma around mental health and the admission of either having it or having worked through it, whatever your situations are. Why do you think it's important, you know, looking at your life and how you mentioned you grew up in a violent home and there were a lot of things that triggered the PTSD in you. Why do you think it's important that there's more awareness brought to that, specifically as we look at young people coming up within our culture today?
Yeah, the first bit of awareness that I like to focus on is the prevention piece. And if I can share my story with parents who have young kids, and you know, these, when you talk about violence in the home, violence in the home has really spiked in America, and in particular in Appalachia since the pandemic occurred. Mom or dad, maybe they're stressed out and they're, you know, they've got substance abuse problems themselves, or maybe they, maybe it's just, you know, one of the things that perpetuates this kind of behavior is, you know, well, my parents did it to me, so I'm going to do it to my kids. And that's how I learned. And so there, you know, there aren't, not everybody is as informed, as intelligent as you or I. And so you have a lot of difficulties there. So prevention and awareness, you know, I've received many, many, many emails from people all over, inside the United States and out, since I published my book. And I've heard so many people say, well, thank you for speaking up because I couldn't, or thank you for sharing, now I understand more, right? Or I had this, I had no idea. And, you know, some of the feedback that I have from parents who didn't grow up this way was, this changed how I discipline my kid. This changed how I look at teaching versus correcting. And so if I just made an impact on one or two people, like, I really was not expecting to get a publishing deal when I wrote this. I was not expecting that more than like my friends would read it. And so to get this is just, Yeah, it just goes to show the need. And there's so many parts of our society that just reacts to what happens, right? We react to what we see on the news. We react to a clip that comes up on our phone. We react to what we see and we don't like. And there is a proactive piece that I think a lot of people miss because they're stuck in reactivity. And the proactive piece, I think, is the most important. Like, hey, how do we change this for future generations? And how do we focus on a way that actually moves the needle? I don't have a solution to a lot of it. I'm just one person, but I'm going to continue to beat my drum the best way I can. And that's to showcase, where you can go when you have difficulties, and that there's always hope, and that don't give up, right? Because you may be going through something for a reason and you just don't know what that is yet.
Oh, yeah, that's so important. And like you said, it's on the rise. I mean, the elements of abuse and violence within homes, within communities, etc., is just it's increasing. You can see the stress level increasing within
Yes.
humankind. And you get to a point where you mentally max out on what you can take, and then it becomes a strikeout in defense. I always look at it kind of like a cornered lion or a cornered bear. Like, there's all this power, and they can control it till they're cornered. And then it comes out against whoever has cornered them for whatever purpose.
That's right.
And it comes out in violence. So when you look at your life journey and the people who influenced your life positively, negatively, and you started on the trajectory in life that you are on, when did faith come into it? And when did that, and how did that start giving you a bit of a paradigm shift from where you were going to who you've become today?
No, that's such an excellent question. For me, it's a bit complicated. I grew up Catholic. My family, they were all very involved in the Catholic Church, my father especially. And I grew up understanding who God was. My mom was a Methodist. I believe I was taught many, many good things by them, right? But because of the nature of what I was experiencing, it really created fissures between my wanting to pursue God or pursue faith any more than going to church on a Sunday. And I don't know how to put it any other way than that. And it really kind of breaks my heart when I look back at it and say, wow, I really needed more of it and not push it away. When I got out of college and into my adult life, because I had so many symptoms and because I was drinking alcohol all the time when I wasn't working, I didn't practice any faith. I didn't have much of a faith life. It's not that I didn't believe. I really just wasn't actively participating in faith. And when I got to the point where my liver started failing, there was way more to it. And I was running a company that had 600 employees, and I was the guy in charge, right? There's no hiding this when I go away for a month, right? And so really, I was in a bar towards the end of my drinking career, 36 or 37 years old, and I was very dishappy, just very unhappy about what was going on in my life. And one of my friends asked me how I was doing, and I just, it was a guy from my hometown, and he just kind of, could tell I wasn't doing well, and I kind of shared what was going on, and he invited me to church, and I didn't say no. I thought about it for a minute because I really wasn't expecting him to invite me to church. I didn't even know he went, and I just said, Pat, what time? What time? Right? And so I walked in Chestnut Ridge Church in Morgantown, West Virginia in 2000, I don't know, 16 or 17, somewhere in there. No, 15. And anyway, it really just changed my life. And I started to build a faith life and build the strength to fix the things in my life that I needed to fix. And then my liver failed. And I left for rehab 4 days before my son's 8th birthday. Like, talk about feeling like a piece of garbage parent, right? You've got a problem that's so bad you can't make it 4 more days before you leave. I mean, it was that bad. And he doesn't remember it. But I brought it up to him when he was older. He was real hard on himself and was kind of beating himself up. And I took him downstairs and showed him a picture of that birthday. And I wasn't in the picture. And I asked him if he knew why.
Yeah.
He said, "No, Dad, I don't." He said, "Because I was in rehab." No one's perfect.
But what a grit, what a gift though, in retrospect. I mean, you can look at something like that as a shame-filled experience or a failure as a parent. Or you can look at it as a moment where God was like, "Hey, let's give your son one of the biggest gifts we can give him and get his dad healthy."
And you're right. And
that takes a lot of courage to do that. You know?
So, Jamie, when I went away to Florida to rehab, the church that I went to in Morgantown produced the sermons and put them online. And so I found that and I just started, I couldn't read the Bible because I was on a tranquilizer. They put you on a tranquilizer as a replicate, for alcohol to get you weaned off of it. And so I was just kind of grounded, so to speak, and couldn't leave the facility. So I just watched church and it changed my life. I mean, absolutely changed my life and for the better. You know, it's not been easy, but it's all been for the better. And it's just, you know, I would hate to imagine where I would be without faith, without God, without him answering prayers. Can't say enough about it.
It's so great. I love to hear stories like this, not because I love that people experience those types of trials, et cetera. Let me qualify that. But I love that you went through what you went through to get to where you are now. You know, but it is one of those things. We live in a broken world, right? And so we all are going to have different broken stories. And what I love about faith and the grace that comes from that relationship with the loving creator is the difference between, and I think this is really important, especially in the mental health, not field, but the mental health arena in which we're talking, is that there's so much shame associated with it. I struggled with extreme anxiety and depression for a while, due to some underlying health things that we weren't aware of that had messed my entire system up. And all you feel is like you're in this pit, and then the pit just gets deeper and deeper and deeper because you can't crawl out of it because you're aware enough of your failings to know what a failure you are. And it doesn't bolster you to go, "Oh, well, I'm going to get better." Then it goes, "Oh, well, I've completely failed." And there's so much shame in it. But then you bring in the element of the grace that God gives as a creator. And when fellow believers rise up around you as they should, instead of the shame or you need to have more faith or you need to do this or you need to do that, but that bolstering of just like, I think of the story in the Old Testament where Moses was holding his arms up and he just couldn't do it anymore. And they kept Joshua falling him, right? And Joshua and Aaron, you know, said, "We'll lift your arms up." You know, to me, that's the body of Christ. That's what faith does. And you lift that up, and all of a sudden the person sees like, this isn't a shameful experience anymore. It's just my story. It's the story that God has, for whatever reason, allowed me to walk in a world that's broken and on its way to healing. And because you can remove the shame from it and the blame from it now, you can look at it with that fresh eyes of, where is God taking me in this? And what is he going to do with that? So where's God taking you in all this, John?
Well, I love that. I love that. I love that explanation. Can I just build on that just a little bit?
Absolutely. Go for it.
So, you know, the main catalyst for me to get out of that shame pit, and I was there. I hear you word for word. I'm just relating that to my own. The catalyst for me to get out of that shame pit was hope, right? And when you read the Bible, going back to the Old Testament with you and Moses, when you read the book of Hebrews, I believe it's in Hebrews 11, the Bible or scripture gives us the definition of what faith is. And it says that faith is being sure of what you hope for and certain of what you do not see.
Right.
Now, that hope part, the first part, is the part that I needed and that mm-hmm. most people in that shame pit need, mm-hmm. because that shame is an echo chamber that just yeah. keeps resonating and playing off the last thought and the last action.
Absolutely.
And when you look at hope, well, that's faith, and it's projected forward into the future, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And it's hope and it's faith that God's promises will come to pass. And that is so, so critical at that fundamental level of, I believe, why 9 out of 10 people with addiction go right back into it.
Yeah.
And maybe only 1 in 10 succeed.
Right, right.
So if I may now answer your question about where God has me now. After I wrote and published this book, what I found was that all these doors that were slamming in my life just opened.
Mm.
And I was given many, many opportunities. And so one of the opportunities I was given, I moved from West Virginia to South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
I have an autistic 4-year-old. So part okay. of that was for him to get the care he needs.
Yeah.
But when I moved down here, I started advising for a company that I've sat on the board of. They're a Christian business. They're Charlotte based, and they build bridges in South Carolina, North Carolina, and Georgia. Mm-hmm. And so I advised there for around a year, and some of the things that I initially went there to do didn't come to fruition. So I actually worked with the owner, and January 1st, I became the president of United Infrastructure Group.
Mm.
And we have around 800 people all in,
right?
And you know, work on some really wonderful jobs, some huge jobs, things that don't happen in the region where I'm from. And I'm with all these stellar professionals that are just more talented than me, and I'm just serving them and helping them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful place. Yeah. It is, and I work with awesome people.
Yeah.
You know, we love it here in South Carolina. We live in Charleston,
okay.
in Mount Pleasant. Mm-hmm. We're about 15 minutes from the ocean, so we can go down and build sandcastles with our kids and enjoy the afternoon if we want to, and leave whenever
That's
we want.
Nice.
And not have to book a vacation to do it. And you know, I'm also playing with writing a family business book for Forbes, mm-hmm. and they've
okay.
extended me an offer.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm kind of kicking that around. And really, you know, my mission is just, I owe God everything, right?
Yeah.
And so I look at it as, well, I can have kingdom impact at work because I mm-hmm. work at a Christian business. I can have impact in my community, and I can, you know, take the economic blessings that I have and help people at home, right? Mm-hmm. Who are back in West Virginia not doing
yeah.
well. And my yeah. church there, the one that, you know, really helped save me, you know, they do a lot of work in foster care and in addiction mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. and in food insecurity, which is just like you would not believe how much there is in the state of West Virginia and in Appalachia. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is heartbreaking mm-hmm. What you see and what you hear in that community when you care and you're trying to give back. So,
yeah.
you know, I have all these wonderful blessings, but I think the best one I have is just my family, you know, my wife, my kids, mm-hmm. Just to be able to have a life now that, you know, I'm not trying to crawl in a bottle to fix every wrong feeling
right.
and be able to enjoy that. I'm not sure I ever believed 10 years, 15, 20 years ago that I'd be in a spot where,
right.
where I would be able to live that life. Mm. And that little boy I was telling you about that I left for rehab 4 days before his 8th birthday, he's graduating high school next month.
Wow.
Right?
Wow. Yeah. And those are the miracles, you know, that we talk about in our lives that we can look at. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important that we don't diminish those as everyday experiences.
You're right.
You know, sometimes we'd look at miracles as like, oh, that's a miracle, when it's something remarkable, like out of this world, miraculous. And mm-hmm. then something like your son graduating healthy from high school with a father who can stand beside him, strong and proud, in the faith and be that. That's a true sign of God's miracle and grace and
Amen.
what he's done for all of us. And so I love the story. I love the hope that you're bringing through your book. Everybody should rush out right now. Rush out. Get Appalachian Kid by John Boyle.
I don't have a picture of it in the background, right? But here's
That's
what it looks
okay.
like. And
There it is. Look at that.
it's a great read, and it's a classy book, and there's a lot in there that I'm sure anybody can relate to, not just those who have my same experience. And
Absolutely. But I think
an
it's
excellent
important,
story.
and I thank you for telling the story and going down that road, because it's not easy, especially when you are struggling through and experiencing PTSD and things that they don't leave. They don't
That's
go
right.
away. It's not like you grow out of them. So to relive a lot of those experiences to write for the benefit of others is a great gift in and of itself. So thank you for that.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Not a
I've
problem.
enjoyed your show, and I could go on and talk with you all day if you want.
Oh yeah, it's a lot of I'm a talker, so that's why podcasts aren't a problem for me. We just sit down with coffee
Good,
and let's go.
good.
John, if anybody wants to find you online, do you have a website or social media or things that people can look you up at?
Absolutely, absolutely. So if you want to buy my book, it's for sale on Amazon. Just go to amazon.com, type in Appalachian Kid John Boyle, and it will come up. There's paperback, hardback, audio, Kindle, whatever you want. If people want to find me, I have a website. It's appalachiankid.com, and it's just a few things about me and a little blurb and who I am and et cetera. And then social media, I don't have a lot, just really LinkedIn. And I'm on LinkedIn there, and really that's where I get a lot of people reaching out and get a lot of messages. And the outpouring has been great, and I hope I've been able to help be a catalyst for other people to find what I've found.
Awesome. Well, John, thank you so much for being with us today. And I hope people go out and check out your story and your book. But most of all, I know that both of us hope that people can be encouraged that there is hope through
Yes.
the journeys and the trial.
Yes, I agree. Thank you so much, Jamie.
Thank you, John. Head on over to YouTube, where you can check out your favorite authors and yours truly as we chat up about books, about all the strange and weird subjects we like to talk about here at Mad Lit Musings. And you can even see our faces because it's video, because it's YouTube. So go check it out, Mad Lit Musings, right now. Are you still here? Go check it out. It's on YouTube. Thank you for joining Mad Lit Musings, where every conversation is a journey and every book is a new adventure. Subscribe now on your favorite podcast player or check us out on YouTube, and let's explore the fascinating intersection of faith, society, and storytelling together.